This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
Yes, it's World Wide Wave time, Joy's international news and current affairs show, taking you around the globe one country at a time. Tonight, we are heading to the northernmost country in Africa, which is Tunisia. Can HIV be used as a tool of change in countries where homosexuality is reviled? How do you turn religious leaders from zealots into allies? And what is the gay community's role in supporting these newfound friends? To understand gay life in Tunisia, tonight we're speaking with Dr. Khadija Moalla, who works for the United Nations in the Middle East and North Africa. And we're also speaking with a priest from India, Father Philip Kuravilla, who is going ahead with leaps and bounds in terms of LGBT rights in India. Here's a taste of what we've got in store tonight.
For instance, in Morocco, we had a sex worker standing up and asking forgiveness from religious leaders. And she said her story, and her husband was HIV, and then he died. She was left alone in the streets with three kids who were hungry. She was forced into sex. As an example, really religious leaders, you know, they stood up and they told her, we beg you to forgive us because it was our responsibility to help you. We didn't do our job.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
In the US, a new report states bisexuals suffer higher rates of discrimination. A report released Monday finds that bisexuals who make up more than 50% of the LGBT community are more vulnerable to poverty, discrimination, and poor mental and physical states than their gay and lesbian counterparts. The report released in conjunction with Bisexual Awareness Week, sponsored by Binet USA, the Bisexual Resource Centre, and the Movement Advancement Project, MAP.
Now, this is particularly important today because it is International Bisexuality Day.
It is indeed.
Which Joy is a big supporter of. 50% of people in America, 50% of LGBT people in America are the B bit.
I know.
Bisexual. That astounds me.
It astounds me too.
I'd just like to point out also that a lot of them stay in the closet a lot more than their colleagues.
Absolutely. The report says that the fear of being stereotyped manifests in a real way, and so that they are more likely to stay closeted, which adversely affects their mental well-being.
Do bisexual people fear coming out, perhaps more so than gay people?
Yeah. What is the visibility of bisexuals in our community here?
Is it almost the turning of the wheel that, 20 or 30 years ago, gay people had trouble coming out, now more acceptance for gay people, but it's not there for bisexual people? Is that just a part of evolution in this? And across to Turkey now, where a trans journalist has been fired from a television station. This is Turkey's only openly transgender journalist, has been fired because she had a dispute with her station's management. She believes that this came about because of her gender identity and a culture of transphobia in Turkey.
And not because she was stealing lunches from anyone else's lunches from the fridge or anything like that. So,
yeah.
Grain of salt, people. Grain of salt.
According to LGBT advocates in Turkey, their television presence was seen as a symbol of the country's positive progression on LGBT issues, and her journalism focuses on LGBT and gender issues not covered by mainstream media. So shame, Turkey, shame.
Over in India, they've actually put on their first transgender news anchor. The transgender female has made history by being hired as the news anchor for Lotus News, which is broadcast in southern India.
And this, of course, comes very recently. India passed some laws which recognise transgender people as a third gender within India. So that is really great progressive news out of India.
In some less progressive news, we've got Egyptian men due in court after arrest for gay marriage video. So, 8 men were arrested after a video showing an unofficial same-sex wedding ceremony went viral. So, many people in
Egypt... It's probably
Egypt,
a country you don't want think something like that to go viral.
Well, it's amazing how many people make a fuss over just a video. Mm. So, YouTube obviously has some issues there, but many people calling for the men to be identified and put to death. So, they had a face trial from today, and they are due in front of a misdemeanor court, fortunately, facing charges of inciting debauchery and offending public morality with their hot, sexy wedding. So, there you go.
Yeah, the public prosecutor's office said it was a criminal act because the images were humiliating, regrettable, and would anger God. Dear me.
Yeah, and unfortunately in Egypt, homosexuality is still illegal.
Now, across to Taiwan, some much better news, or news on the horizon, perhaps, where a legislator from the Democratic Progressive Party has promised to put marriage equality to the parliament in the next parliamentary session. I will definitely put gay marriage on the agenda, she says. Is Taiwan ready for same-sex marriage? We will soon find out if it makes it to the floor.
I think at the moment they'll do anything to differentiate themselves from China.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah,
you know, that's why they're pushing so much to become a bit more more Western, liberal, democratic, because it's, it makes it harder for China to roll it back.
There is a ground roots kind of support for this, though. For more than 100 LGBTI and civil society groups formed the Marriage Equality Revolutionary Front to lobby Parliament to move the bill faster and protested outside of Parliament last week. So awesome stuff.
Some good news coming out of America in San Francisco, actually, where blood donation, they've done some calculations. If gay men are allowed to donate blood, it could save over 1 million lives, a study has found. So currently, gay men are not permitted to give blood, as is the case here in Australia, and they are looking, as in many countries, to change laws so that blood donation is based on risk as opposed to sexuality.
Yes, apparently the law was changed in the United Kingdom and in Canada, which now allows, after a certain period, for gay men to donate blood.
If they haven't had a sexual partner in 12 months, good luck.
Another area where, well, perhaps this fits in with that comment, actually, San Francisco is set to become the first city to offer free PrEP treatments, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is anti-HIV drugs that prevent HIV. And a trans story where a young trans person, just aged 14, has written a children's book. She wanted to tell her story and share her story with other trans children who were growing up. So she's written a book called I Am Jazz, and it has been published. It's out now in the USA.
Yeah. You mean an old-fashioned book on paper and
a
stuff?
A real kid's book, yeah.
Do they still have those?
Yeah, occasionally.
Oh.
Yeah.
And the final story for today, across to Brazil, where football is huge, akin to the football show, Men Wear Skirts. Not quite. A school has a school disallowed a transgender girl to wear skirts. So what happened? All the boys at school got dressed up in skirts.
Oh, they were just eager for an excuse.
Love it.
We've talked
beautiful
about Brazil
support
before.
Of solidarity. Beautiful.
Maybe they were showing solidarity to Scotland as well.
This is the World Wide Wave.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, Worldwide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
This is Autumn Butter from LGBT Center of Mongolia, and I'm happy to be on Worldwide Wave.
It's Worldwide Wave, Joy's International News and Current Affairs show.
Tonight we've stopped in Tunisia with Paul, Matt, Lana and Dean.
And we've had a message in.
We have had a message.
Hello, Sean. Thanks for your message. I love you guys. You always do a great show. I would befriend or date a bisexual any day. Does that mean, Sean, you're turning for somebody?
No,
but that's just very progressive, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's just open. And,
just open,
you know,
and
that's it.
Thank you, Sean.
If one comes along, that's it.
I didn't realise we'd turned into a dating show.
Hey, we'll be anything you anything
helps,
to be.
Anything
you want us to be.
We will be.
We're going to kick off with our fun fast facts. So both male and female same-sex sexual activity is illegal in Tunisia. So don't forget, we're right up in the far north of Africa, bordering on the Middle East. It's probably not surprising.
Mm. Although it actually relates back to when it was French colonial administration. They introduced the penal code, I should say, back in the 1900s, 1916, I think.
And most of the country's Muslim, so those Islamic traditions and attitudes are, prevail throughout the community.
Might be on the Mediterranean, all sort of, sun-kissed and stuff, but yeah, not as much fun as we'd like it to be.
But it's quite interesting that it's both male and female same-sex activity, because so often in countries in which same-sex sexual activity is illegal or criminalised, they kind of forget that women can actually have same-sex sexual activity. So to put it specifically that it's illegal for women as well is, shows how serious they are about this.
They might forget, Lana, or they might think it's hot, all that hot girl-on-girl action because it wouldn't be the first time we've got homophobes that think, women together is, bit of both.
Let's not go there.
Although it's unusual in Tunisia for women to cover their face, it's actually quite progressive in that way for a Muslim country.
The homosexual laws are actually rarely enforced, which is good news. So there have been a few instances, but largely they are not enforced.
However, the new government of Tunisia is officially Islamist. It was elected to power by 41% of the population versus a divided group of secularist rivals who are all at each other's throats, and therefore they got in. So, unfortunately, arrests for homosexuality have been on the rise. Remember, listeners, long-term listeners in particular, we are still in Africa, sometimes resulting in jail terms from which some prisoners, victims of harassment, rape and violence from other inmates, never return. Before 2011, transsexuals and drag queens could be seen in the streets. Now they have sadly disappeared.
Now, there's no LGBT organisations in Tunisia either, so it's still yet to go. But there is a magazine?
There is a magazine, Gay Day magazine, but there's also organisations that work around Tunisia and try and go into Tunisia. For example, toleranceforarabs.org is one that I came across.
Unfortunately, the magazine was actually attacked online in 2012, and their posts were replaced by homophobic slurs.
As much as that's the bad news, we've got a few good news things coming up with our guest. We're speaking with Dr. Khadija Moalla, who works for the United Nations in the Middle East and North Africa. She's an expert in international law and human rights and doing great work in the area of HIV and AIDS.
Hello and goedenavond. This is Elko, listening in from the Netherlands on Worldwide Wave, the latest LGBT news and current affairs on joy.org.au.
And you're here tonight with Dean, Paul, Damien, Lana and myself, Matt. And we have stopped off in Tunisia. We had the pleasure of catching up with Dr. Khadija Moalla, who works with the United Nations in the Middle East and North Africa. She works specifically in the area of HIV and AIDS, working with at-risk populations. And she has taken on the enormous task of gaining allies from religious leaders in the Middle East for the fight against AIDS. We caught up with her recently at AIDS 2014 here in Melbourne. In your presentation, Khadija, you said AIDS is the entry point for human rights. What did you mean by that?
It means that sometimes it was hard for us to put on the table some rights or to have the facility or the opportunity to talk about it. AIDS gave us, during the last 20 years, this opportunity really to fight again for human rights because of the entry. Let me give you an example. Like for LGBT rights, there is almost not a chance that you go and talk about it with religious leaders. But from AIDS perspective and because of AIDS, it was our entry point at some point after building trust for more than 4 years that we've been able to put it on the agenda.
So you've actually named two influence groups that are needed to help in the fight against HIV, the media and religious leaders. Why religious leaders?
Because they are trusted much more. The study told us that they are the most trusted people, better than politician or medical doctor or whoever. So in one hand, they have the best outreach. They can reach out to thousands of people every single Friday. They speak directly to the community, meaning that in your mosque or church, you can have everybody, all the classes, all the gender, everybody. This is very important. And for our experience working with people living with HIV, they needed to be accepted by their religious leaders. It was not important for them that their medical doctor or the president of the NGO accepted them. They badly needed really to be accepted by their religious leaders. And I can tell you, the day I had one gay person from a country being able to pray behind the religious leaders after a workshop in the same room, and both of them knew each other, it was really a success, because both of them felt they accept each other. And it was a huge achievement for me.
That must have been incredibly hard to get those two groups together. How do you get to the point where religious leaders are advocates on HIV?
Took a lot of time, of course. It took many, many, many years, because you need to build trust with them. You can never go with any type of secular discourse. You can never go with your own agenda. You have to respect them. You have to listen to them to see where do they come from, to understand exactly what is it, and then to present them with facts, but not only facts, to let them really live the experiences, speak with people living with HIV, speak with everybody, get them to have that experience. Because you know the problem with religious leaders, when they are trained, they think they know it all, simply because they know the holy text. And by allowing them to provide them with a new knowledge through the leadership methodology, they will discover there are so many other things. And also by listening to the real stories, because they have prejudices. Well, for instance, in Morocco, we had a sex worker standing up and asking forgiveness from religious leaders. And she said her story, and her husband was HIV, and then he died. She was left alone in the streets with three kids who were hungry. She was forced to sex, as an example. Really religious leaders, you know, they stood up and they told her, we beg you to forgive us, because it was our responsibility to help you. We didn't do our job. And then they wanted to be part of the solution, because they understood that they were part of the problem in the beginning.
There must have been some religious leaders who didn't agree, didn't participate?
In the beginning, yes, but because I started with the highest level of leadership. I want personally to meet with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar. I want personally to meet with many, many Mufti of the Republic. And once we discussed with them, presented them with the consensus in the beginning and everything. Then they came back. The first meeting, there were 80 of them, the highest ranked, and they did sign a Cairo Declaration. It's only when they signed that declaration that it opened the door for me to go, for the whole team to be able then for many, many years to train all the other second level religious leaders, because they got the green light from their highest authority.
You've also suggested that there is a need to support religious leaders who are risk takers, the ones that do go out ahead and say, we will support LGBT or support people with HIV. Why in particular do you think that's important?
It's important because, you know, they are the one taking risk. Because when you are courageous religious leaders and you suddenly go back to your congregation or go back to your community or other religious leaders who have not been trained and tell them, a person living with HIV is our brother or sister, I'm quoting the Cairo Declaration, he is taking risk because they don't understand, they haven't been trained. So you have to be always with them. They need to feel that we are a community, and the more strong and powerful we get, the better.
Khadija, we love your passion. Thank you for joining us in Melbourne.
Joy 94.9.
That was Dr. Khadija Moala, who is working with the United Nations in the Middle East and North Africa. Her first comment, AIDS is the entry point for human rights. That's quite a fascinating concept, really.
It's an interesting twist on something that's so so negative that can actually have a positive outcome.
Yeah, and she's really driving. I mean, she's an absolute dynamo. Mm. Chatting to her, she's, you know, this incredibly dynamic person who... it would not surprise me if she bailed up an imam or somebody and just convinced them. Sell ice to Eskimos, I think. One thing, though, that she kept coming back to in that interview was trust, the need to build trust. There wasn't trust, to respect the religious leaders and not tell them what to do, let them learn until they feel trust, this incredible thing. I'm really surprised that that she has been able to achieve what she has in a country where homosexuality is illegal.
Well, she sounded very persuasive. I'd listen to her.
Yeah, I certainly did. It is. It's quite astonishing to think after she talked about HIV being the entry point to human rights, she talked about HIV being the entry point to talk to religious leaders about LGBTI rights. And the very thought of such a country in which persecution is so prevalent to talk to religious leaders. And she used words like courageous and trust and risk takers for these religious leaders, going out there and actually developing those relationships and building those bridges. So it was quite astonishing for me to be able to hear those things and to go, wow, that's what's happening.
And the simple fact that every Friday they pull a crowd of 20,000 people, therefore you've got an instant audience. So if you can convince the person that is speaking to that audience, well, all of a sudden the information flows.
Bit of a Trojan horse.
Indeed. A message through from Richard, listening in from Adelaide. Thanks for your support, Richard. Love having you with us from Adelaide.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
Hi, this is Janne, Mr. Gay Finland, and you are listening on the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
It is the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time, and we've been talking Tunisia, and I guess the good, the bad and the ugly, some disappointing things in terms of LGBT rights, but some impressive changes with allies in the religious community. And we also tracked down a priest in India, whilst it's not Tunisia, doing the equivalent fantastic work in India. We spoke with Father Philip Kuravilla from the Indian Orthodox Church about the groundbreaking work that he is doing for LGBT rights and HIV in India. I'm here with Father Philip Kuravilla, who is a priest in the Indian Orthodox Church and working with the National Council of Churches in India. Father Philip, what are you doing to educate priests in the area of HIV?
This has been an ongoing program. More than 10 years ago we started. There is one particular organization that actually does the examinations and gives degrees to priests who are not from the Catholic background. And this is called the Senate of Sarampur. We persuaded the Senate of Sarampur to have a paper. One of the papers every priest has to do, besides his theology, is on HIV. And they have included it as of last year. So every priest coming out from any theological seminary in India has to have some knowledge on HIV. Naturally, we've also written a book, because if you don't have the information, they've got to go searching for it. So a book has been brought into the curriculum and a paper has been brought forth. This is for all over India and it's really making a difference.
And it's multi-denominational too, so you're working across very different churches inside India.
Yes, National Council of Churches has a wide variety, from the Orthodox on one side to the Evangelical on the other. But the beauty of it is, over a period of time, almost all of them have come to realize the importance of working with HIV. And so when we put something forward, it goes through the processes. But finally, the National Council of Churches passes it, and then it's binding on 30 member churches that belong to the National Council.
There are countries all over the world where the kinds of key populations that are affected by HIV are usually the ones that butt heads with the churches. How is it that India has been able to bring together these minority groups, these marginalised groups, and the churches?
Since I've been in this right from the beginning of the Christian response to HIV, which started with the Ecumenical Church Leaders Conference in Mumbai in 2003, I must admit, it is our counterparts in churches in different parts, I'll admit, mainly from the West, that have brought us to think or rethink about many of these issues that we have. LGBT, gender, marginalized communities. Normally, the Indian church, like any other of the Indian faiths, would not have taken these up. But we were definitely in advance of the others. And now the good news is, we're a little behind and the other faiths are ahead. But they took over from us, and that's the good news.
How important is it to empower faith leaders with information to be able to help combat HIV?
In this conference, you might have seen various reasons we give why faith leaders have got great inputs into their faith communities. People have got a long trust of a faith leader, and when he or she says something, it's gospel truth. And so if you could win over a faith leader to your way of thinking, or bringing to his or her notice some of the important issues and allowing him to say, yes, I believe this is important. I believe it's important to talk to the LGBT community. I believe there is space for us to dialogue. I think it's the greatest good in the world, and I believe the faith leaders can do more than the United Nations and other governments can do.
Engagement with religious leaders on HIV as a public health issue is one thing. Have you seen any changes in attitudes towards LGBT people and their issues and their rights as a result of this process?
If I must be frank, yes, there is positive change, but it's very slow. Both sides really distrust one another. The LGBT community distrust faith leaders because traditionally they had no space for them. Faith leaders have difficulty to go through the responses of the LGBT along with their traditions and their scriptures. So we have actually gotten by into looking into the scriptures of various religions and how they can come forward with something more positive than just, no, there is no way that we can come together.
Joy 94.9.
And that was the voice of Father Philip Kuruvilla from the Indian Orthodox Church and taking a great lead in India for HIV prevention, but also LGBT rights. That word trust came up again.
Again and again and again.
How important is that in being able to engage with religious leaders? He did say right at the start there, religious leaders from all over India, not the Catholic faith.
Yes, I don't pick that up. But over 30 members of the council of the churches in India have signed up for this paper.
And interestingly, similar to Dr. Moala that we spoke to earlier, they started at the top. They got buy-in from the church leaders right at the top of the chain, and then things started to flow. Then other leaders. It seems to give it some credence, some weight for other priests, down the chain to actually, you know, take this on board as a serious issue.
In both the interviews, there was the importance about the truth and the message coming from the religious leaders, that was actually important to the LGBT members of those churches, that the leaders were actually speaking and talking about these issues.
Yeah, no, and just following on from going down the chain, to create a format or a program in which it's educating priests and all priests, regardless of the denomination that are signed up to this agreement, have to learn not just theology, but about HIV and about LGBTI.
Yeah, it's been formally built into their curriculum. Yeah. So it is, it's become a standard.
Yeah, it's quite an astounding comment he made at the end, though, that he believes that faith leaders can do more than the government or the UN.
And again, I think that comes back to that thing, they can pull a crowd.
Yeah.
They're trusted and they can pull a crowd.
Yeah.
And people believe them.
If you could bottle it, politicians would be buying it by the gallon.
I think they do by trying to associate with religious leaders as much as they can in order to appeal to certain segments of the community.
Perhaps. Yeah. He did say, when we asked him the question about, you know, okay, HIV is one thing, but LGBT rights, you know, how serious is that considered? And he said, yes, there has been positive change, but very slow.
Mm.
So, you know, it is, heading in the right direction.
Yeah.
But it's a bit harder for the religious leaders to advocate for LGBT rights when for centuries they perhaps haven't.
But at the same time, it's only been going since 2003. That's only 10 years. Think about what changes we've had and only 20 years ago when I've come out and the massive changes that have had in that community. 21 years ago, it was still on the DSM, still seen as a psychiatric issue.
Disorder. Yep.
In Australia, only, you know, 25 years ago, and states still illegal. So in the 10 years in India, I think that they're doing pretty good.
He did acknowledge that there was a lot of distrust between the LGBT people and the religious leaders. Mm. So there's something to break down there, but at least, yes, as you said, Matt, they're going in the right direction.
Now, for Australia, I guess we haven't had the religious buy-in as much on the issue of HIV. It has been very much treated as a health issue. Do you think there is hope in breaking down the barriers between the gay community and religions? Oh, silence. I'll take that as an item of concern.
That's a definite maybe, I think.
Yes. Yeah, definite maybe. We'll see.
So do we need to engage with them? How do we build trust with religious leaders here?
That's a good question. And it's one in which, you know, it's about leaders of communities standing up and developing those relationships and having that common agenda. And, you know, so do we have that? And the thing is that our leaders aren't. So our LGBTI community leaders aren't so much. So is it really necessary for that to happen in a place like Australia is, I think, a bigger question.
I think we should be asking the Spirit Lounge about that. Let's contact them and see what they have to say on their show.
But do the religious leaders in Australia have the understanding of LGBT issues and HIV that they seem to have in India?
If they listen to us here on Joy, undoubtedly they do. You're on the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hola, mi nombre es Felix de Colombia. You are on World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
It's the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time.
Or two tonight.
Or two tonight, actually. We have, yeah. We've been to Tunisia in Northern Africa with Dr. Khadija Moala from the United Nations and Father Philip Kuruvilla from the Indian Orthodox Church. Thanks to them for their time.
Awesome. We have messages. We've had Joe, Carol, Maddie, Felix, Alex and Christine who have joined or interacted with us on Facebook. So we want to say a big hi to them.
And a shout out too to Richard and Sean who've messaged in the show too.
Yes, thank you very much. And commiserations to the lovely Gordon who's usually here.
Scottish Gordon.
That's Gordon.
On the front desk.
He's usually at the front desk, but he's wailing and gnashing his teeth over in, you know, over in wherever he is at the moment because they failed in their vote.
We've got a heap of shows in the pipeline. Kazakhstan, Myanmar, Vanuatu, Laos. We will be back same time next week. This has been World Wide Wave on Joy.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.